Welcome to another edition of the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Ann Doyle's been around. The author of Powering Up, How America's Women Achievers Become Leaders, has worn many hats. Her professional career began in the early 70s as a radio reporter. Then it was on to television news. But in 1978, Ann was offered an unexpected opportunity to move into TV sports, giving her the distinction of being one of the first women to break that all-boy barrier. It happened at the CBS affiliate in Detroit. And while that may have been challenging, unsettling, and overwhelming, Ann had an ally and a mentor in her dad. Vince Doyle, a professional athlete, was one of the deans of sports broadcasters in Motown at the time. He was president of the Detroit Sports Broadcasters Association. Despite taking a lot of heat from his male peers about a woman in a man's world, Ann's dad was behind her 100%. For her work in opening locker rooms to women reporters and her nearly 15 years in journalism, Ann was inducted into the Michigan Journalism Hall of Fame and is listed in Who's Who of American Women. From broadcasting to business, in 1987, Ann joined the Ford Motor Company, where she became director of North American Communications. In 2001, Automotive News named her one of the 100 leading women in the North American auto industry. After taking early retirement from the corporate world, Ann went out on her own, starting a leadership and communications consulting practice, Ann Doyle Strategies. Her work as a speaker and women's leadership consultant has taken her to some of the top corporations, including GM, AT&T, Dow, and recently she went to Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and Trinidad under the auspices of the State Department to speak on women's leadership and changing gender roles. You exhaust me.
I doubt it, Sandy.
Welcome. I want to travel back in time to the 70s. And I want you to tell us how you started in the broadcast business. I mean, is that something that you aspired to when you were going to college, or was it more happenstance?
Well, you know that as girls growing up in the time we did, that our aspirations were pretty limited in terms of what society was telling us. And I remember that my father, I'm the big sister of seven children, and I remember standing next to my father one night, and he said to me, Annie, you are going to be either a superior mother or a mother superior, because we're Catholic, Irish Catholic.
I assume
so. And I distinctly remember knowing he was complimenting me, but thinking, I don't like either of those choices at that point in my life, you know. And but luckily, I really came of age at a time when incredible opportunities were opening up for women. And I was very, very hungry for all of that. And so in terms of why I went into broadcasting, my father was a sports broadcaster. My mother taught speech and debate at Indiana University. I mean, we were a family of communicators. But I have an undergraduate degree in Spanish. And so my parents really sat me down when I was a senior in college and said, are you planning on teaching Spanish? How are you planning on supporting yourself? And I said, no, I really don't want to do that. And I didn't know. And they really had a great conversation with me about what my skills were, what my interests were. And they really said, how about broadcasting? You know, you competed in broadcasting in high school, you know, and that kind of stuff, you know, in debate and broadcasting. How about that? And I said, yeah, that sounds kind of interesting to me. And I was still, I had one more semester of college to go. And they said, why don't you go to the student radio station and see if you like it. And then my father also said, you know, there's a program at Northwestern University, Medill. And my father had gone there. And he said, you know, there's a great program there. Why don't you investigate that? And those were things that they sort of guided me, I would say. And then I went and explored.
But that's so interesting that they had, that they played such an integral role in your life. My parents just sent me off to college. And ironically, I studied journalism there, but not because they had any influence. I just wanted to find out how I could be famous. And I knew that it wasn't going to be in acting or, you know, how they always say, I have a face for radio. Do you know what I'm saying? That you never even thought about that. And they really played an important role in your life, which is really kind of fascinating.
Well, yes. But the other funny part of it is because, as I said, I'm one of seven children. I have an older brother, Danny. I'm the big sister. But I actually never applied to college. My parents never actually sat down. I mean, they didn't take me to colleges and explore different universities. It was sort of assumed we were all going to college. And it was a very, very busy household. And I remember at one point, my parents sort of said, well, are you all set in terms of college? I had done nothing.
Wow.
I had done nothing. And my parents really, my mom, I sort of assumed I was going to go to Mundelein College in Chicago because my mother went there. But I had no understanding of the college application process.
Well, where the hell was your guidance counselor?
Oh, my goodness. There were 950 students in my graduating senior class at Elkhart High School. I never saw a guidance counselor ever.
That's crazy.
Ever. Right. I mean.
So if it wasn't for your parents, in a sense.
Yes, you could say that's right on every level. I mean, I had
stunning.
Fantastic parents.
That's
And they didn't, you know, they didn't drive us. But they encouraged us, they supported us, and when we needed help, they were there.
Now, did you start off in your professional career, did you start off in a big city like Detroit? You remember how they used to say you have to cut your teeth in Podunk and then you can come back, well, to New York or L.A. or whatever, and I would assume the same thing would be true of Detroit.
What happened to me, number one important piece, is that at my own university, I was working at the student radio station. Of course, I'm the only female working there.
Doing what?
Doing news.
Okay.
Doing radio news.
College
on
news.
The student station. But I also volunteered at the National Public Radio Station at the University of Michigan, WUOM, as an intern. And the news director at that station specifically called me over and said to me, are you the new intern here? Yep. He said, do you see this line as he stood at the news department? Yep. Don't you cross it.
Meaning what?
Don't come in here to put something on my desk, to read the newswire, to answer the telephone, because there is no place in a newsroom for a woman. This was my university in 1972. That's what he said to me. And so you go from that. I mean, the thing is that at that moment, I knew he was wrong. I knew he was wrong because of my parents, and I knew he was wrong because of the possibilities that were opening. And, of course, there was Barbara Walters, but I had never heard a woman do a radio newscast, ever. I just had to sort of listen to men and then use my voice, but I'd never heard a woman do a radio newscast.
Right, as you're speaking.
There were none.
No, well, in New York, there were definitely women here, yeah.
We're just beginning, you
right.
know, at the very beginning. But, you know, and I was in Detroit area
sure.
at that time. And so it was really at the very, very beginning. And but, of course, the other part of that story, we all have stories about the men who said no or stood in the way. But we all have stories of the men who said yes and who gave you those chances. And, of course, you know, it was a man who hired me for my first radio job.
Which was where?
Lansing. Lansing, Michigan.
And you were hired as a general reporter, general assignment reporter?
Radio news reporter.
And you knew what you were doing?
No, I didn't know what. Well, to a certain degree, I remember that what happened with that was that my father actually, once again, parents intervening. My father called up a friend of his who was the news director at the station, and he said to him, would you give Annie some interviewing practice? And this man was the TV news director at the station. Sure, send her over here. We'll put her through the practice. And I went over there, and he sat down and talked to me and gave me some advice. And then he asked the radio news director to do the same. And so that guy did the same with me, and he offered me a job. And I remember sitting there and him telling me what the job was going to be. And
were you able to process all of that in your head?
The little voice in me was saying, because he said, okay, you're going to cover the Capitol and you're going to cover the police beat and you might get calls in the middle of the night. And he's telling me what the job is going to be. And a little voice inside of me is screaming, get out of here. I can't do this. Get out of here. But my father always told every one of us, never, ever eliminate yourself. And I heard his voice too.
Wow.
And I just looked at him and I said, no problem. Okay.
We got it. We had to clone your dad.
And a great dad.
You know?
And a great mom.
Right. We're not forgetting your mom. And so you go out in your first beat. Maybe you tripped over yourself a little bit. But for the most part, did you find out you really loved it and that you had made the right move?
Yes. I go through the world as a reporter. For all the things that I have done, I mean, the way I'm moving through the world is I'm a reporter.
I feel the same way.
Do you feel that way?
I really
do.
And I'm forever asking people questions and really interested in their answers also. I don't think you can ever lose that. In my case, I started out in advertising, but my first on-air job was working for the In Touch Radio Network, radio service for the blind and visually handicapped. And I had a talk show, and I never told anybody that was a volunteer job. And that led to my first job right outside New York City. But again, I was still a novelty because I was female. And
oh,
I
yes.
think that that really worked. In, at least in my favor, I have to assume in yours too somewhat.
Oh, of course, because it drew attention to you.
Exactly.
And there were so few, you know, you were unusual. And so it drew attention to you. And if you were good.
Well, you know, in my case, I had a deep voice. And that's also what helped me. Well, there are not too many women with deep voices. Oh, whatever, you know. I mean, and if I needed to grow a beard, I would have done that too. Tell me how you got into sports.
Well, as a radio person and a journalist, you know that the way you move through broadcasting is you start in smaller markets and you're always looking for bigger, 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 bigger.
Right.
And I went from radio news, then into TV news, and I was in Grand Rapids, Michigan, doing TV news there.
And let me interrupt. Was that a smooth transition? I didn't mean to leave out television, because that's huge to go from radio to TV.
It was pretty smooth. It wasn't gigantic, but of course, you know, I'm part of that Jane Pauley generation. You know, it was happening around the country, and it was happening with every profession, whether you were a judge or a lawyer or an engineer or construction worker. You were the only woman there.
Yeah.
You were the only woman there.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were alone. And but you also had this sense that you were part of something bigger than you.
Mm-hmm.
And so your job was to do the very, very best you could as the only woman there and to keep pushing the edges. And so the natural thing was to move into TV reporting. And then, of course, I was insisting that, well, I think I should be able to anchor. Or I think I should have one of these Sunday talk shows that the guys have. You know, always
How
asking
old were you?
For
–
Well,
you?
I was probably 23.
Ooh, young.
24. Well, you know, I just graduated from – I mean, I was in radio for about a year and a half and then moved pretty quickly into
That's
TV.
That's impressive. That's not a very long stint, you know, in radio to move into TV. I think that's terrific.
Mm-hmm.
You don't agree?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think everyone's path unfolds,
mm-hmm.
and certainly I had opportunities. You
mm-hmm.
know, I mean, you have to go after them. And I'm not a person that sits around and waits. You know, I'm a person that is always kind of looking ahead and could see what the next thing. And I grew up with my father on television,
right.
So he was in radio in Detroit and some television. But I grew up my entire life with my father on television. We're starting to see women, and,
right.
and it's the same thing. Well, I can do that.
Right. And could you? And did you?
Yes.
Successfully?
Yes.
And you felt really good about it?
Yes.
And how many of you were at your station?
One.
Excellent. So you had there all by yourself?
Right.
Any mentors there?
I was hired to replace a woman. I was not the first woman. And this was the ABC affiliate in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which was a pretty good size market at that time. It was about 37th in the country at that time. It was pretty good. And but I was hired to follow a woman by the name of Martha Teichner.
Of course.
Do you know Martha?
I was CBS Sunday Morning.
Right.
Oh, she's
right,
wonderful.
Right. Martha Teichner. And I never met her at that time, but basically she had been hired to go to the CBS affiliate in Miami. And then she went to the network, you know, from there. And so they were looking to replace their woman reporter. And they had Martha Teichner, an incredible reporter. I mean, she's the Christiana Anampur of
Fabulous.
That time.
Yes.
When Christiana was growing up, Martha Teichner was in every hot spot in the world.
Absolutely.
I followed her at this TV station.
Wow.
And so the news director said to me, "You have some very big boots to fill." And I took that. I was not going to let down Martha Teichner. And I mean, Martha Teichner, whether she knows it or not, was an incredible inspiration to me.
That's a great story. You were in TV for how long?
5 years.
5 years. And then move us to sports. Sports as a woman, I mean, this
right.
is nothing to sneeze at. This is really huge.
Right. Well, there was an interlude in there, which I'll mention very quickly. And that was, is that, you know, I was always looking for a bigger job and putting out tapes, but I didn't get it. And so eventually I basically said, I'm leaving. And so I left and I moved to Los Angeles. And so I started looking for jobs in Los Angeles. And I remember the TV news director at the ABC affiliate, you know, sitting there in his office, and he said, "You know what? You have a lot of nerve coming from Grand Rapids, Michigan to Los Angeles and think you're going to get a job here." And I'm like, "Well, I'm pretty good," and blah, 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 you know. And he said, "But you know what? I'll tell you what, I like your guts." And he said,
"I like you, girl. You've got spunk."
And he said, "I'm going to give you a job as a writer." And I said, no, I don't want a writer job. I'm an on-air reporter, and
good
I'm not
going to
get stuck in a writer job.
Good for you.
And a couple weeks later, I was actually hired by the independent TV station there by a woman news director to be a fill-in anchor. And I'm on the air anchoring the news as a fill-in in L.A.
Excellent.
And that news director saw me up on the monitors, and he called me, and he said, good for you.
But he didn't offer you a job.
No, no. But then, so I was out there for about a year and a half. And I was also, at that time, volunteering to raise money for the ERA.
Mm-hmm.
So I was doing that kind of work, too, but earning money, anchoring. But I really wanted to get back. My parents said, you got to get back full time into TV.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was really looking for a news job. And I really wanted to kind of come home. And so I was looking for news jobs in Detroit, and I went in and, you know, went home, visited my parents, and was interviewed by the stations, and the CBS news director, he basically said, you know, we'd really like to hire you. Your stuff is good. But he said, I don't have a news job right now, but how about doing sports? Now, did he know that my father was one of the deans? My father was very well known in Detroit. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
He knew that my father was Vince Doyle.
Mm-hmm.
My dad didn't get me that interview. But my dad had nothing to do with that other than that this man knew that I was Vince Doyle's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And he was thinking about adding somebody to their sports department. And he said, how about doing sports? Well, I knew the second he told me that, what that would involve.
Meaning what?
I knew it would involve fighting the locker room fight.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was a TV news journalist.
Mm-hmm.
I knew what was going on. And that's
sure.
what was unfolding in this country.
Sure.
And I knew that it would involve stepping into that fight immediately. And I also knew it could be very controversial for my father. And so I said, well, let me think about that. And I went home and I was visiting my parents and sat down at dinner. And, you know, they said, hey, how'd the job interviews go, Annie? And I told them, you know, that they offered me this job and that's great. And then I said, yeah, but they want me to do sports. And my father literally put his fork down mid-bite.
Because he was stunned?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at me, he said, really? And I said, yeah. And he said, you take that job. And I said, but Dad, if I take that job, I'm going to have to get into this locker room fight. And he said, oh, yeah. He said, you will have no credibility as a sports reporter if you do not go in those locker rooms. And that was it.
And you were willing to take up the mantle?
Absolutely. Because to me, again, that was the mindset I think many women of my generation who were this group I call pioneering interlopers had that mindset,
mm-hmm.
that we were ambitious. But we also knew that we were opening doors. We were opening doors for others and that we knew opportunities for others would be based on how well we did.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, it was, there's this expression in Spanish, te toca, which kind of means it touches you,
mm-hmm.
but it kind of means this one's for you to do. And I knew that needed to be done and that I knew that because I was a TV news journalist, I had all the skills of a TV news reporter, and that I grew up with sports around our dining room table every single night, I knew that I could do that job. And I felt that I was supposed to do that
job. So there was never any doubt in your mind.
Well, there were moments, definitely, standing outside those locker rooms, especially the first times.
Talk about the Kirk Gibson story from 1979. You don't have to restrain yourself with the language either.
Okay. Well, of course, you have to force yourself to walk through those doors at some point because you don't know what's waiting for you on the other side. And, of course, women who did that were tested. Things happen in those locker rooms, and you have to expect to be tested. And my father warned me, you're going to be tested. And so one of the things that happened was Kirk Gibson was a very, very famous Detroit Tiger. He was a very big star at Michigan State. He went on to – he was a World Series MVP, played for the Los Angeles Dodgers. But he was a rookie, just come into the Detroit Tigers at that time. And I was in the locker room, and he had joined the team late, I think, so because he was finishing up college. But so I was in the locker room after a game. I was interviewing a player, and all of a sudden, you hear this loud voice basically say, this is a fucking man's locker room. Get the fucking pussy out of here. Well,
yeah, really.
Suddenly there was silence. And the player that I was talking to, Lance Parrish, he was the catcher for the Tigers, his face turned totally red. And, of course, all the sound stopped in the room. There was silence except for the music in the background. And I turned around and looked. And here is Kirk Gibson, stark naked, with a little tiny towel slung over his shoulder, strutting across the middle of the locker room, heading
like
toward the
diva.
Showers. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And he said it again. Now, if you looked around that locker room, there was only one female in that room.
And that
there
might
be. There were probably about 50
Ann
men.
Ann Doyle. Mm-hmm.
Right. And so I turned and, looked back to the player, and he looked at me and he said, he doesn't speak for all of us. And I finished the interview, and then I intentionally stayed in there longer and did more interviews.
With different players?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Because of not being chased out of there. But I was steaming.
What about humiliated?
No, I was angry.
Just angry?
I was angry.
Wow.
And I said, but, you know, I had to do my job and then get out of there. And of course, I have a cameraman with me always. And these guys half the time didn't want to be in there with me, as you can imagine. But I remember I went to my father later that night or something, told him what happened. And, you know, I basically said, I don't have to take this. You know, I'm going to go to Jim Campbell. I'm going to go to Sparky Anderson. I do not have to take this. What should I do? And my father said, you do nothing. And he said, you're being tested. Don't go running to management and ask them for help. You just go back in there and keep showing them that you belong there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then the end of that story is that a few weeks later, Kirk Gibson, as always, hits the grand slam winning home run of a game. The guy you've got to have an interview with. And I went into the locker room and, you know, there's like a scrum of reporters around him and you're trying to push your way through to get your mic in there and get a camera shot. And Gibson at one point looks at me and he stops the interview with like 15 reporters. He looks at me and he said, Ann, you don't have to push your way through all these sweaty guys. Just hang on a second. I'll give you an interview. And I stood there, and then he talked a few, and then he said, okay, guys. And then he stepped away from them and said, Ann, what do you want? And he did an exclusive interview with me.
Stunning.
Kirk Gibson and I never talked about
that issue.
What happened? Never.
He never apologized.
No. Didn't need to. It was a test. And the thing, the important—
But how the hell was he to, well, to he, pose that test?
Oh, he was on the cover of Sports Illustrated.
Oh, forgive me. You know, silly me.
It's, you know, and that's why having a father who could help me navigate those gender landmines was so important.
Yeah, that's huge.
Because
no, it is
I
huge.
Could never have figured that out on myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was because I didn't go running to management. I just went in there and did my job. But I didn't, you know, I didn't let him scare me.
What about having called his bluff or said something back to him?
I don't think that would have helped.
Mm-hmm.
I think it wouldn't have been very, it wouldn't have earned respect from others. It wouldn't have been graceful. It would have been,
no,
you know, just ignore him.
By far took the
don't,
higher road.
Right.
Yeah, no,
right.
You're very classy.
And another, other male athletes often said to me, you know, and, you know, there's usually just a few key guys who are the stars who everybody wants to interview. But there's a lot of other players in that room,
mm-hmm.
and they watch what's going on.
Sure.
They watch. And they watch how you're tested, and they watch how you handle
it. A hugely seminal moment in your life, needless to say.
Yes. Yes. It was a huge moment. And in those moments, you're going to be tested. And I divide those into, you know, they're either what I call springboard moments, where it lifts you to a higher level.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're kind of mirror moments, and they say, you know what? You're not ready. You got some more work to do.
Wow.
And that one was a springboard moment.
To say the least.
Yeah.
There's understatement
but,
for you.
You know, I mean, so I really wasn't scared of boardrooms or anything like that at Ford Motor Company or other tests. You keep getting tested, but that one was really very important in terms of my strength.
Would it be inaccurate to call you a ballsy broad?
I don't mind that. Someone gave me a book just recently that's called 4,000 Years of Uppity Women, and it goes all the way back in time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that whole saying about you're going to make history, you know, you have to kind of rock the boat.
Which you've done.
I believe in that. I believe in that. I believe that I'm I believe in human evolution moving forward, and that you have to keep pushing the edges of possibility. That's how we grow.
And so that's what you've done. So you moved from broadcasting into the business world.
Right.
Was that a natural transition for you? How did that happen? Why did that happen?
Well, if there's one thing I think that a strength that I have a brother, Tommy, who said to me one time, "Ann, you're the best quitter I ever knew." And he meant that as a compliment. And it's basically, you know, having the ability to sort of understand when it's time to move on, to really sort of read it, understand it, that I'm not growing here. I've lost my joy. Whatever it is. And you have to sort of understand that about yourself. And then you have to have the courage to move on, mm-hmm. and go look for the next thing. And that's really my pattern. And I would say that that's one of my strengths. And so I knew in television that I had gotten as far as I could in terms of trying to, my next step would have been to crack the networks. And the networks flew me in to New York, interviewed me, but they were hiring Phyllis George and Jane Kennedy. They were hiring Miss America to do sports at that, you know, they
yes,
were not
yep.
ready
mm-hmm.
to hire a woman to do real sports reporting. And so I basically said, you know what, I'm done. My mm-hmm. work is done here for me. And so I'm going to move on to the next thing. And I was right about that. If you look and see how many women are doing sports today, truly, not many.
Right.
So I moved to Atlanta. I started a little small communications business. That's another transition that I went through. Did a lot of work for Coca-Cola. You know, just sort of trying to see how I could take my communication skills and move them to the business world, because I was interested in
the business world. So that was the next challenge for you.
Yeah. Yeah. And then what happened really was I did that for about a year and a half, using those business skills, but selling them really independently to corporations and things like that. But it gave me a look inside the business world. And then it really just happened that I fell in love in Atlanta. I married a Detroiter I met there. 6 months after we got married, his father orchestrates a job for him back in Detroit. So suddenly now I'm married and, okay, I guess we'll go home to
yes.
Detroit.
Well, you didn't have much of a say.
Right. And so what happened there was I was really going to start do my business back home in Detroit. Well, if I could do it in Atlanta where nobody knows me, I'm sure I can do it in
for
Detroit
sure.
where I know lots of people. And so, of course, if you're going to do that kind of business in Detroit, you go to the auto companies. And at that point, I mean, Ford basically said to me, no, we do not have any business for you. We've got a job for you. They were really kind of looking for me at that time. They were looking for someone in their communications area who knew television. Most of their people came out of newspapers or automobile magazines, technical magazines.
There's a little kismet thing going on here with you, right? You know, right place, right time kind of stuff.
Yes. I think you have to be open to possibilities and you have to be like turning over rocks and looking,
mm-hmm.
but definitely opportunities come.
And so you joined Ford.
I joined Ford.
And
right.
you have a big job at Ford.
Pretty big job. I mean, upper management level. And then, but I came into Ford in really as the number two person in what they call their broadcast news office, which was that job was really to handle everything to do with any kind of radio or television news coverage of Ford Motor Company anywhere in the world, really. Anywhere in the world. So, I mean, it was incredible because it could be anything from 60 Minutes or, you know, buildings blowing up or, I mean, you know, terrible things happening at factories or things like that or exposés or union contract negotiations, launching new vehicles. I mean, the auto industry is such a big industry and a complex industry. I mean, every possible news story that could happen evolves at a company that big.
How great is it that there's a woman running an auto
Mary
company?
Mary Barra,
yes,
just named
GM,
CEO of
right.
General Motors.
Yeah.
We call that the steel ceiling in Detroit, the auto industry. And you can imagine there was just dancing in the streets and the hallways when that happened.
But you know what? There's a part of me that says, hey, you know, you go, girl. But then again, it's 2014. I can't even believe we have to.
You thought we'd be a lot further
out, Sandy. I just don't get it. I just don't get it. And apparently a lot of people don't get it because that propelled you to write a book called Powering Up. And there's a part of me that feels why do we need this, even though it's so vital to have? Do you see the, you know, the conflict there? Are you not stunned by that conflict?
Well, I wrote the book because people for a long time would say to me, and you should write a book, you should write a book, because I do have some pretty good stories. But I told you I'm a reporter, and so I was always interested in, okay, if I'm going to write a book, how do I move the conversation forward here? What's next? And so I really thought very deeply about what was it that all these other women out there knew that I knew what I knew, but what had they learned? And so when I looked at the whole big picture about what was going on, it was very clear to me that in the last four decades that we have become this nation of high-achieving women. There's millions of educated, professionally seasoned women, but that the middle keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, but that we are stalled. We were completely stalled, and that we were not cracking the top, and that those numbers hadn't changed at all. And that's why it was very clear to me that the next piece of work, the next frontier, was women moving into top leadership roles in the big numbers. We once saw women moving into those male jobs in the 70s and the 80s. And so I really wrote it as a call to action. And also as the graduate work. It's, okay, you're a high-achieving woman. You've mastered all that stuff. You think you're leadership material. Now do this stuff. Now master this stuff. And I'm very happy about Sheryl Sandberg and her book,
Lean In. I was going to ask you about that.
I'm very happy about that because, you know, she's Sheryl Sandberg. She has a global voice. I mean, she truly has raised awareness about where we are right now in a way that Ann Doyle could not. My book came out 3 years ahead of hers, and her book, she missed 20 years.
By virtue of her age.
By virtue of her age. And so she was sort of stunned, I think, in some ways by what she found, you know, once she got into the business world and everything. I think she was stunned by it, which led her to write Lean In. I lived it, and so I wasn't stunned by it at all, but I appreciated it because I think too many women are kind of squatting on the work that was done in the past. And so my book is truly for women who leaned in a long time ago and are now ready, and they are the DNA, they are our gene pool for women to power up, not in exceptions to the rule, but in big, big numbers, and take our places alongside men in the top leadership and decision-making roles in every arena.
So how do you feel about how far we've come, or have we come far?
Well, I'm an impatient person, Sandy, and I really had to come to terms with culture changes slowly. Of course, it's not as fast as I would like, but we are moving, and that I believe we are right on the verge of another tremendous sea change in this country, and I believe that we're going to see it, but that we cannot take it for granted, that we have to put our shoulders to the wheel, and each of us needs to answer the call, Te Toka, whatever it is that's your piece to do. You need to do it because women have not begun to leverage our collective power. And once we do that, the world is going to be a better place. People said to me one time, you know, Anne, you're always telling other women to run for office. Why don't you run for office? Well, I finally did. And so I ran for office. I was elected to my city council and served on that. And this is one of the most important things that women can do, is to run for office yourself and to get more women in office. We are like 30th in the world in terms of the women in political power.
I think we're behind Afghanistan or something ridiculous
like that. It's ridiculous. It's terrible, and that affects so many things. It affects policy. It affects everybody's lives. It also, because when women are in elected office, it's a very public position, and it changes attitudes about women in leadership roles much more than women inside corporations who a lot of the public don't necessarily see. It's very, very important. And another idea that I have about that is I think that there's a gene pool, a talent pool of women who are powering down a little bit while they're raising younger children who should be running for local office, because these are part-time positions, your city council, your school board, your county commission. They're part-time positions, and they look great on your resume.
It's a good way to get your feet wet, to get started.
Absolutely.
That's great advice.
We are desperate to have more women in elected office.
But there's that old adage of can we have it all? And I'm on the other side of this. You know what I mean? I'm not just starting out. I'm just kind of, you know, ending in a way. And I get exhausted for the women who are younger than I am. I feel for them. While it might have been challenging for you and me, it was still different. In a way, it was almost easier.
I know exactly what you're saying. And I think, you know, Deborah Spahr, the president of Barnard College, has just written a wonderful book. And I grabbed it and read it as fast as I could. It's fascinating. She calls it Wonder Women. And she's really writing about the younger generation of women. And she basically explains a lot of it. And she says that why it has gotten so much harder. And one line that she has in there where she said, you know, these girls grew up being told that they could do anything, and they heard they had to do everything. And I think that's the problem. Nobody does everything. Men don't do everything. And women still, because we are the you know, we birth the babies and we parent differently than men and probably always will. You have to make choices, and it certainly is possible, and you just sort of integrate it and carve out your life and don't get stuck. You certainly can have a very fulfilling career if you want it and be a wonderful mother and have a great life. You can do that. Doesn't mean it's easy, but you can do that, and there are a lot of women who do it, but just make your own choices.
That's a great way to end the show. Anne, thank you so much
for being
here today. Join us for another edition of the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.
Thanks for listening to the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. For show comments and suggestions, please follow us on Twitter at Sandy Klein Show. You can also find us on Facebook at the 51% Conversations. The show is produced and recorded by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studios in New York City. Sandy Klein is our executive producer.